Welcome to the On the Shelf podcast, sponsored by Pharmacy Times. I am your host, Joanna Lewis. I am a pharmacist and creator of the online platform, The Pharmacist Guide. This podcast focuses on anything you can find on the shelf, including skincare, beauty products, supplements, and over-the-counter medications. We also touch on mental, physical, and emotional wellness. Today, we will be talking about the professional side of wellness, which to me really encompasses the physical, mental, and emotional. I am so honored today to welcome Lydia Finette as our guest. She is a global thought leader, international speaker, and ambassador at Christie's Auction House. She was named one of New York's most influential women by Gotham Magazine and has been featured in multiple publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, and Crain's. She's appeared in Vogue, Harper's Bazaar, Vanity Fair, and Town & Country. She is also the best-selling author of The Most Powerful Woman in the Room Is You. In this book, she shares her knowledge of commanding a room, getting comfortable with building and selling a business, and ultimately creating and designing a life that is meaningful to you. We are so excited to have you today. Welcome, Lydia.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be on.
Well, I think your book cover is pretty recognizable. It's this beautiful pink, The Most Powerful Woman in the World Is You. But many people may not know the whole story of the person behind the book. Could you give us a brief introduction about yourself, your time at Christie's, and what really led you to write this book?
Absolutely. The book really came to be as a result of the fact that I have been an auctioneer at Christie's for over two decades. And it started because when I first tried out to be an auctioneer, I was 24 years old, and pretty much every other person who I'd ever seen in this industry was male. Many of them were British. They were a lot older than me. And when I tried out, I felt so insecure in the person that I was because I didn't look like what I thought I was supposed to look like in this job. And that was really compounded in the first decade of my auctioneering, where almost every time I went to take an auction, I was sort of quizzed as to why I was the person there and there wasn't a guy who was showing up. And it almost always ended with some combination of a woman somewhere in the audience or backstage or sitting next to me at dinner saying something like, you know, that was amazing that you did that. I could never do what you do. I could never stand on stage and ask for things. You know, I have a business, but I just hate selling things and I hate selling myself more than anything. And I would always think to myself, it's so interesting because I didn't grow up in cultures where women are taught to go after things with abandon. I mean, I grew up in Louisiana in the Deep South, and my mother is British, which is also a culture that's quite sort of stiff upper lip. And especially if you're a woman. And I realized that I had learned all of this from being an auctioneer on stage for, at this point, when I wrote the book, it was 15 years into my career, and of being knocked down by people saying no and learning to accept that I could bring my authentic self to that stage night after night. And that is what worked for me. And because I learned those lessons, I could teach those lessons to other people. And so I ultimately ended up writing this book, The Most Powerful Woman in the Room Is You, to inspire women to be okay with selling and understand that there is power in femininity, just as there is power in masculinity. And the book cover is hot pink because so many times, especially when I was first starting out, I would wear a black suit to be an auctioneer. You know, I felt like everything had to be so serious. And what I realized over time, when I came into myself as an auctioneer and realized that this was a skill that was truly mine, something that I had developed in my own style as a woman, that I started to wear color, and not only color, but bright, beautiful, bold colors. And that's when I felt strong. I didn't feel strong in a black suit. I felt like I was an imposter. I felt strong in a hot pink dress. And that's really how the book came to be.
I love what you just said about style. And I've seen that on your, yes, like on your social media, you always have these just beautiful prints. No, I love that. Also what you said about inspiring women, like that's really what your book did for me. And I really believe that certain books or certain experiences come into our lives at the right time.
Yes.
And when I read your book, yes. And I, when I was introduced to your book, it was the time when I needed some, like a good kick in the pants. And I really kind of needed to take charge of a few things. And something you said at the beginning of the book really stuck with me. It said, or you wrote, you are the only person who can change the course of your life. you can be whatever you want to be and you can do whatever you want to do, but you will need to learn how to use the voice inside to sell your way to the life you want. Can you maybe elaborate on that and maybe a time when this mantra really kicked in your life?
This is, in my opinion, the most important part of life. And for some reason, we all seem to miss it because we look around us waiting for somebody to pluck us out of the crowd and teach us or tell us that we can do something that we already have the power to do. And I find this mantra in my own life almost daily. You know, I was telling you before we got onto the podcast that I took a car auction, which is such a departure from what I've been auctioneering my entire career. And even in the moment when I was asked to do this by a firm that came to me and approached me and asked me if I wanted to try this as the first woman in the car industry, I thought to myself, you know, is this really what I want to do? Should I be doing this? As if somebody was going to have that answer for me. And the answer is that I have the answer. Do I want to do this? Yes. Should I try this? Yes. Is it going to be scary? Probably, but that's okay. That's where I want to be in my life, pushing myself into the uncomfortable, because that's when I really grow. And I think so many times we look around, especially as women, it's like we're asking people for a permission slip that doesn't exist in life. Like, you don't need to ask anyone permission to live the life you want. You, as a person, need to go after what you want and stop asking other people if it's the right call, because ultimately you're the only person who can make that decision.
You know, that's so true. And I know often, I think for me, I was really hung up for a long time because I was like, I want to create this roadmap, but I don't even really know what I want. Mm-hmm. And it took me a long time. Yeah. Like, and even kind of what you said about putting yourself in uncomfortable situations, it took me like trying a lot of different things. And I feel like even it's taken me till almost like the last couple of years to really, you know, have that confidence. But part of your book and part of your roadmap and what you were saying about going after something, you have developed this strike method that is, you know, a metaphor with how the auctioneer at Christie's. Can you talk a little bit about that or just maybe elaborate if a listener hasn't heard about it?
Yeah. So when I was writing my first book, I really was trying to bring readers into the experience of being an auctioneer, because, you know, if you even have heard about the auctioneering world or seen a picture, you're probably one of, you know, a handful of people. It's not the most common world for sure. And when I was writing the first chapter of the book, I started to think to myself, what do I do when I go on stage? How do I explain to people what it's like to be backstage before an auction with 1,000 people watching a video? And then you just have to go out there with one piece of paper and try to raise $1 million in 20 minutes. Like, what is that experience like? And someone had said something to me years ago about the fact that every time I walked on stage, I slammed the gavel down 3 times. I don't think that I knew that I did that before he mentioned it. He made a joke. He said, you know, you should patent that move, because everybody knows it's you, because when that gavel hits the podium, no one else does that. And because I don't attend other auctions, because I take the auctions usually if I'm there, I didn't really know that that was different. But I realized that I did it almost as a way to calm myself before I started speaking. Because as you can imagine, I mean, the adrenaline is surging before you go out on a stage, especially with that many people. And so I realized that every single time I went out there, I would slam the gavel down 3 times and I would look up at the audience and say, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Lydia Finette. I'm so delighted to be here from Christie's Auction House. And then I would throw in a joke. And the important thing about that first sentence after slamming down the gavel was that I always knew what I was going to say when I walked out there. So I was never in a position where I was fumbling for words. I was never concerned that I didn't know what I was going to say. And it occurred to me that that was how I got rid of my nerves immediately. My voice was never shaking. I was never turning red. Gavel slammed 3 times. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And I was off to the races. And so I realized that I had almost started doing that in business meetings as well, where I didn't obviously come in with a gavel, although I do work in the auction world, so that probably would have been acceptable. But, you know, for the normal person who's walking into an office or getting on a Zoom call where they're really nervous, I think there needs to be something that's prepared in your mind that helps you overcome your nerves and helps you realize that you're always in a position of strength when you're talking. You are the speaker. So, you know, if you are a nervous speaker, you need to mitigate that so that people are paying attention to what you're saying. Nobody looks down when I slam my gavel and launch into my spiel. I have at least a couple seconds before people start talking again at an auction. So it's similar when you walk into a boardroom, or if you're having a difficult conversation, you need to make sure that mentally you have your own strike method, whether that be physical, like, you know, putting, I have a friend who taps underneath the table before a big presentation as if to say, here we go. I have another woman who I coach who does, she has a red stone that she found on a beach and she just sort of grasps it in her hands. And she said that that just makes her feel like she's ready for whatever's coming her way. But then lining up those sentences afterwards really are going to help you stay in a place where you feel like you were in a position of power, which is what the strike method is about.
No, I really need to incorporate that. Just listening to you talk, I was like getting, you know, like you said, like you get, your palms get sweaty, my voice will shake before presentations. And I just love how you get, you have this little, you know, this little ritual that just kind of calms the nerves.
Yes, absolutely. And we can all do it. It's not, it's, as I said, it doesn't have to be a gavel. You just have to find something either mentally in your mind that calms your mind and gets you ready, or physically that allows you to transfer the adrenaline into something else.
Okay. Yes. That's going to be applied in my life next week.
There you go. One takeaway. No, all you need from podcasting.
Yes. I'm learning. So there's another story that really stuck out to me in your book. And it's when you realized you weren't getting paid your worth. And I think, you know, our, like in healthcare, they usually have pretty standardized pay scales, but they do post a lot, you know, men visit like a male physician versus a female physician, et cetera. And I had a similar experience maybe 2 to 3 years into my career. And I just love how you said you wallowed a little bit and then you kicked it into gear, put a pitch together, and then you really used that. You gathered your information and used that to get the promotion you deserved. And you also said how you essentially created your own job. Could you tell people about that? Because I love just your blaze, like how you blazed your trail and you just adopted that mindset.
Yeah, honestly, I don't even know how we've gotten to the place where we can be in positions where we're still getting paid less for the same job, except that I have also run teams of people and I have seen people not ask for the raise time and time again. So a lot of times when I think about what that looks like year over year, if you start asking at the age of 21 for an incremental increase versus your coworker who doesn't, male or female, you see what that looks like. And men are just taught, or men absorb in a different way than women, I have found, that they should be doing this. Someone told them this secret many years ago and somehow it missed an entire generation of my friends and myself. And so I found myself 10 years into a career where I had been paid literally not even a half, a third of what I was supposed to be paying. And I found it out, and you can read this in the book, but through a series of different conversations that I started having. And in this particular time period, I think women are much better about educating themselves. That's what social media is about. That's what you see. Women who are talking about finance on social media are constantly saying, like, you have to ask, you have to ask these questions. You have to ask for the raise. You can't just accept that they are going to give it to you just for showing up for work. And in my case, you know, 10 years into my career, after I found out that I was getting paid so little, I essentially went to my boss at the time. And, you know, and I've said this many times since, I don't think that this is the best strategy. I think a much better strategy would certainly be getting your boss invested in your career and ensuring that you guys are on the same page about when you will be getting pay raises and what those pay raises look like. In my case, I didn't really have anyone talking about this. So I just had my own, as I said, I wallowed in self-pity and then I got angry. And that for me manifested itself in a pitch for a new business that I had wanted to write. I wanted this new business because frankly, I'd been in my job for 10 years and I was tired of doing what I was doing. And I went in and I basically just told them that I was quitting in 2 weeks, which was not true at all. I did not have another job offer lined up and I didn't necessarily even want to leave, but I just was so furious that it was what came out that day. And it yielded an incredible result because I got everything I wanted. Plus I never had to leave, which was essentially exactly what I wanted. And I got the pay raise that I deserved and was finally being paid market rate. So that story for me, and I told that story and I wrote that story when I was still working full-time at Christie's, knowing that it was definitely going to be a little controversial, even though my boss at the time was no longer there. And I'm still very close friends with him, but I felt it was so necessary to say it because I think for so many years, so many of us had just sort of sat there and been like, oh, thank you so much. You're right. I work for the glamour of this job and I don't really need to get paid for what I do. And I don't really care that everyone's making so much more than me, when in fact, all those things you should care about. And it's okay to care about that. Nobody works for the glamour of a job. You can choose to work for a job where you don't get paid as much, but you should at least have that information. And that has been, for me, the baseline for conversations about compensation that have happened ever since. I've always asked for more money. I have no problem asking for more money. Half the time I didn't get more money. Sometimes I got less money because of the pandemic and things like that. But at least I asked and I never felt taken advantage of. And I never felt like I didn't ask, which I think is the most important part, because you are putting yourself out there and you're also steeling yourself to learn about hearing the word no, which is an inevitable part of any kind of negotiation. So I think all of those lessons over the course of your life, if you're doing them at a young age, it's going to teach you that reflex of being fine asking, being okay hearing the word no, and then sometimes yielding the desired results. And all of those things together, in my opinion, make you an incredibly efficient worker, a great manager, and ultimately a great leader, because you're learning what that conversation looks like, not only on the back end, but hopefully when you become a leader, so that you can have that conversation with the person in front of you.
No, that's amazing. No, I love that. And what you had said earlier in the question or in the answer about, you know, just ask. And I've been on the offering side of jobs and, you know, reaching out to candidates and offering. And I really, men do always like push back, where I think women often were just like, oh, thank you so much for having me. We're so afraid that, you know, we think we're just lucky to have the job. And I don't think we, you know, maybe stake our self-worth or think about the value that we're actually offering.
Or get concerned that people aren't going to like us. You know, we don't want to run away, because we want everyone to like us. That's what we're taught, is a validation of who we are as women at a very young age. It's about being liked. And if you're not liked, then are you doing the right thing? And you know, luckily, I mean, I have two brothers and I have a great husband and lots of guy friends. And we talk about this all the time. It's just, they almost think of it as sport. They think it's funny to go in and negotiate and ask for more. And they don't mind if they're rude, and they don't really care what that looks like. And I have said to them so many times, like, I can't even imagine using the words that you just used on a negotiation. I think people would be so shocked if I walked in and demanded something. I mean, God forbid, you know. But again, I think that this is all part of the learning process of ourselves, of being more assertive. And again, you don't have to go in there. And I talk a lot about the sort of male energy and the female energy. You don't have to go in there and demand something if that's not who you are. Use your own words. What do you want? Use your words to ask it. If you're a person who tends to be positive and happy, you don't have to go in there and slam the door and start throwing stuff. That's not who you are. So use your own words, but be firm and understand that it's not a bad thing to hear the word no. It doesn't mean that you're asking the wrong question. It just means that it doesn't work at that moment.
No, that's so true. So I'm going to pivot just a little bit, because this is a wellness focused podcast, and maybe, and I know you're a very active person. I think from what I've read in the interviews I've heard, you've always been, you know, you've exercised and physically fit. Mm-hmm. Do you have any specific, you know, self-care wellness rituals that just keep you grounded in your busy life right now?
I mean, exercise for me has always been my wellness ritual, which is, I know that sounds kind of crazy, because I know people have a love-hate relationship with it. I have always found that exercise for me is the one thing that reduces any kind of anxiety, any kind of, you know, if I'm tired or sad or bored or any of those things, like just even if it's 15 minutes, 20 minutes, you know, I'm lucky that I live in New York City. I can just put on my shoes and go walk. But running, any kind of biking, cycling, swimming, I mean, anything I can do to just move my body and get my breath to a place where I'm not thinking about really anything except just everything. I don't know how else to describe it. I call it like my third brain. It's at the top of my brain, and I can only access it on a long run or when I'm doing something really physical. That is the most important part of my wellness ritual. And, you know, the rest of it, whether it be, you know, making sure that my face is in good shape and all those things, I truly believe I just look better when I'm moving my body.
I mean, that I love your answer, because it resonates with me, because I always like that to me is my foundation. If I exercise, everything else falls into place. And I always feel like, yeah, there's all these wellness things I can be doing. I can be meditating or, you know, doing all this other stuff. But I think when I exercise, all of that other stuff just kind of comes naturally.
Yeah. I mean, when people talk about meditation, to me, the most meditative state I can be in is during a long run. You know, if I'm out for an hour running, I've completely lost track of time. I don't really know what's going on. I'm only thinking about the things that need to be unlocked in my life. That always hits. If I'm upset about something, I can sort of, you know, have those conversations. Even I'll find myself sort of like talking to myself while I'm running, or, you know, singing along with music. But I remember when I was writing my first book, anytime I would get stuck in a chapter, I would go for a run and I would have to stop with my iPhone while I was running, because all of a sudden the word would come to me, or the way that I wanted to phrase something, or a new idea would pop into my mind. And, you know, I shared with you earlier, and you know this, but my family was in a car accident and I was finishing my second book really in the last 2 months after the accident. And I was coming back from some pretty, really, really tough injuries. And, you know, I had fractured my back and I had broken 7 ribs, and I certainly could not go for a run at that point. And so it was really interesting trying to finish the book without being able to get into that meditative state. And I really had to push myself to, you know, on walks, almost find that again, so that I had the opportunity for my mind to be clear enough. Because, you know, again, if you're running and you find that meditative state like that, but you can't run anymore, how do you find that again? Where do you find those words? Where do you unlock that? So it was an interesting experiment in trying to do something without a really important tool in my life for the first time.
No, I mean, that's so true. Like, exercise is your meditative state in this mm-hmm. instant. And this kind of like flows into my next question, because, you know, you had talked about after your accident and you had to finish this book. What I really took away in your first book was your tenacity. Like, you showed up and did the work. And I know you gave an example when you were doing PR and marketing for your book, and you would bring the same energy, whether there were 500 people in the room or 5 in the room. And I think that's, you know, to me, that's all about your mindset. I think a lot of other people would get discouraged and maybe just in half of themselves, or maybe cut it short. But can you just maybe elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, it's something someone said to me many years ago, when I was about to get on stage one night. It was really late and I was really tired. And he said something to me about energy, and I was kind of half paying attention. And he said, well, you'll be able to see when you get on stage, because obviously you bring the energy you want from the room. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, that is the clearest way to say something I have ever heard in my life, because it is so true. If I want an audience to be excited and on fire at 11 o'clock at night, then you better believe I have to go on stage with more energy than you can even imagine. And I learned that at the book signing too. You know, every single person who got there showed up for me that day. So why should I walk in there and be sort of like, oh, there are only 5 people here, you know, I should treat this like, you know, a second-class citizen moment. Rather, why not show them that I appreciate them and show up the same way that I would show up if this was a packed house? Because also, you never know who's in a room. You know, out of those 5 people, it could be the person who publishes my next book. You never know. So that's really the most important thing, is that you bring your full self every single time.
I mean, that's kind of even part of it goes into networking. Like, you would never know who you're going to see, right? You could, that person in the elevator that you have small, like, you chat with could be the CEO of, you know, the company that wants to publish or make your book into a movie.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes. I know part of your previous role at Christie's, you were a global, or you're an ambassador now, but you did a lot of global partnerships. Mm-hmm. And when I hear that, that just sounds overwhelming. Like, how do you make all these connections? How do you reach out to people? And again, I think we have a thread going, the same themes are throughout this podcast, but what are some of your tips for connecting with somebody or putting yourself out there?
I think that people in this day and age get so nervous about pushing a send button on an email. I think it was so much more difficult 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when you didn't have the ability to reach out to someone over social media. You know, if I'm looking to get in front of someone, I will usually just DM them on Instagram. I kind of find out what social media platform they're the most active on, that they're tweeting on, or they're, you know, putting LinkedIn posts, or I'm not on TikTok, but you know, maybe I should be, I don't know. Instagram is my main vehicle. It's my main social media vehicle. And people reach out to me over DM all the time. And if I have the time to meet with them, I'm happy to do it. If I don't, a lot of times it may be a month or so that'll pass, and then I'll get back to them and say, you know, let's meet tomorrow, or let's meet in 2 weeks. But I think the most important thing about reaching out to someone is not, is just remember that they're a person, you know, and be, if they're someone you really admire, lead with that. You know, tell them what you like about what they do, and how you have been touched by what they do. And would they ever be open to a cup of coffee or a 15-minute Zoom? Or if not, like, you just wanted to say hi, because nobody will ever look at that and be like, oh, that's so annoying that they did that. It's not annoying to receive a lovely email or a lovely DM from someone just saying that they admire what you do. And then try to find a time that works with them. You know, I don't know if you're where you live, or again, a 15-minute Zoom, if there's anything that could work at any point over the course of this year, that would be great. And that's usually the easiest way to meet someone in this day and age. But don't be scared of sending an email. Don't be scared of DMing someone, because if they don't respond, they don't respond. It's nothing on you. It probably just means that they either are busy, or maybe someone else runs their social or something like that.
No, that's a great point. So this is kind of different, but kind of the same. How would you navigate like mom friendships? You know, like in this stage of life, it can be very isolating, but it can also be very rewarding. Yeah. And you know how the mom culture is. And I see you, you know, I follow you again on social media, and I know you've had some great girl trips lately.
Yeah.
But what... how would you reach out? Like, I'm sure there's a lot of inspiring women around you. And like, what if you want to get to know somebody, how would you reach out to them without, you know, sometimes I think mom relationships are kind of like dating.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, absolutely. You know, I'm not fearful of friendships. I collect friends. I love being around people. I love meeting new people. I also understand that not everybody feels that way. So I'm just respectful of whether or not someone seems like they want to be near me or with me or friends with me. And I don't really take it I don't really take offense if they don't, because I understand that, you know, I may not be the kind of person that they want in their life, which is completely fine. You know, I think we're all an age where we know what we want out of life. We know what kind of people we like being around, and we don't need to force those friendships if they don't exist. But, you know, if it was a mom friend, I mean, the easiest way, as my parents always used to say, like, children are the greatest social ambassadors there are. And, you know, you end up finding all these friends just because your kids are the same age, and whether or not you even really like them, you just have to be friends with them because they are the same age and they want to hang out together. But with mom friends, you know, if you have someone who has a child that's relatively the same age, reach out and make a play date and say, you know, I'd love to have that person over and would love for you to come over too, so I could get to know you a little better. I don't really know you that well, or something like that. I think that's the easiest way to do it. Something casual and easier, meet in a park or on a playground. And I think that should not be a worry of people, because there are enough people. And I do think being a mom is such an incredible equalizer. You know, we're all in the dirty diapers together. Nobody gets out of that phase. You don't get to not be part of the dirty diaper phase, you know? So reach out on the commonalities. And I feel like a lot of my best friends have become in these mom years. I have close friends from college, but I certainly have really, really close friends that have come out of my children, and my children are my greatest gift, and those friendships are too.
No, agreed. There's something to be said for these, you know, collective experiences. And like you said, children are great, you know, a great social equalizer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so so it sounds like you finished your second book.
Yes.
And I'm very excited to talk about that. But for your first, and your second, what was, and again, this was a little self-serving because, and I know you and I had connected a while ago, and you kind of gave a group of us some tips about writing your book, which was amazing. How did you tackle that? To me, this is just like such a monster of a project, and this can really apply to a presentation, anything big that we want to do. Like, how do you break it down in the day by day?
For me, it's all about micro steps. I mean, honestly, everything I do in life, when it seems too daunting, I just start at the beginning. You know, where do I start with this? So I wanted to write a book. My first book, I had about 3 months to write it. I didn't really understand what it took to write
crazy.
A book. Yeah. And I also had only written a chapter when I sold it, because it was just sort of, it was one of those strike while the iron is hot. I had a book topic literally on I'd written a chapter of it, sent it to a friend's agent, and she agreed to represent me the same week that a New York Times piece was coming out, where I told them that I was writing a book called The Most Powerful Woman in the Room Is You, but I wasn't writing a book. I'd written a chapter. I had a loose agent, and then she posted it. It was 2 weeks after the Harvey Weinstein scandal broke in the New York Times. And all of a sudden I have a book called The Most Powerful Woman in the Room Is You. And everybody wanted a book about powerful women all of a sudden. I assure you, if it had been the year before, this book would never have sold. It just was, the timing was so perfect. And all of a sudden I had meetings with all the big publishing houses with this new agent of mine. I mean, we hadn't even signed a letter. And then I had an offer on the table within a week. And actually I had more than one offer, which was the most incredible part of it. And when I went in to meet with the team, they said to me, so, you know, how quickly can you write this? And I said, well, you know, I have to be honest, I've never written a book. So you guys tell me, I'm a fast writer, I think. And they said, well, how about 3 months? And I was like, yeah, then that sounds about right. You know, meanwhile, I have, at this point, my youngest was 9 months old. I was still nursing her full time. I was working all day in the office. I would go home, put the babies to bed, go back out and take charity auctions at night. You know, I was getting up at 5 to nurse them. I mean, there was no time. And which I think is also actually when you should do things, because when there's no time, that's when everything gets done, in my opinion.
You're motivated. Yeah.
Yeah. You're on such a fast forward that it's just sort of like throw one more thing in. You're just functioning at such a high level. And basically, I remember after I got home thinking to myself, actually, I take that back. I wrote another chapter and submitted it. And my editor was like, this is great. I love this chapter. Listen, just be really mindful of the word count. And I said, what's the word count? And she said, the number of words that are supposed to be in a book. And I said, well, where is that? She said, it was in the contract. And I said, well, I sent that to my lawyer. I didn't dig into that, I'll be honest. I didn't really like unpack every part of that very long contract. And I said, well, how many words do I have to write? And she said, 70,000. And I said, well, how many words do I have written right now? And she said, not even 10. And that is when I've never in my life, I think I just, all of the blood drained out of my body. I think I blacked out at that moment. And I remember going back to my room and sort of looking at Eloise, my little, and being completely shell-shocked. Like, I'd written this, I mean, I'd signed a contract saying that this book was coming in 3 months. And so I sat down and I said, okay, if I don't think about 70,000, if I think about 60,000, and I think about 3 months, I need to be writing about 1,000 words a day. Like, that needs to be my aim. And I need to just exercise this muscle, just like I would train for a marathon. It's not about the 26.2 miles, right? It's about the 1 mile. And once you do the first mile, then the second mile comes. And then you just have to not look at the final product. You have to look at the beginning and just think about what you can do that day to get closer to it. And that was where it started. And I wrote 1,000 words for 60 straight days. And I remember I finished my book on the plane to San Diego. I was going to San Diego for an auction, and I was there for, you know, not even 24 hours, just sort of there and back. And I finished it and I started to cry so hard because I was so stressed. And the man next to me was just looking at me. And I was like, I can't even explain to you. I just don't even understand. I don't know how to explain to you how stressed I've been, and you don't know me, but I just finished this book. And I don't think I really realized how much pressure there was in finishing it in that short of a time. So they gave me 6 months with my second book, which felt like a great amount of time until I had a car wreck in the middle of it. But I will say that the micro steps for the second book were 500 a day, and that worked as well. So I would say to you or to anyone who was looking to write a book, just get in the habit of writing every single day. And with my first book, I wrote at night. I would get home after the auctions or after the babies went to bed, and I was exhausted, but I still did it. It was an hour to an hour and a half a night. And my husband would wait to watch an episode of The Crown every single time I finished. And that was the motivation. I would just disappear in the room. And I was like, I'm not allowed to watch anything. So sometimes it was 10, sometimes it was 11. But, and then with my second book, I wrote in the morning because my kids are older now. And so they don't get up, you know, they're not up at 5, they're up at 7. So if I got up at 5, I could crank out an hour to 2 hours if I needed it. And sometimes with 500 words, it was less than that. And if I wrote more in one day, that would subtract from the day after. I mean, it's a whole thing. But you know, if I was feeling great and I wrote 2,000 words in a day, I didn't have to write the next day. So I would just say, get into the habit, set a timeline, and just stick to it, and don't let anything throw you off that timeline. And I think eventually you'll get there.
No, thank you so much for that. And isn't it funny how children make us morning people?
Yes, I know. I was such a night owl until I had children. Now I love the mornings. I love them.
I know. Same. Well, I just have two final questions because this is on the shelf. And I know you're a mom and, you know, you go out a lot and obviously take care of your skin. What is your favorite over-the-counter skincare product? And then what's your favorite, maybe like luxury or designer product?
My favorite over-the-counter skincare line is pretty much anything that has a sort of deep moisturizer. So even something like a Nivea, which I found when I ran out of my other moisturizer that I used a couple of times this summer, which is sort of like really like deep, gets in there and you feel like you're getting a lot of moisture and you wake up and your skin looks really refreshed. So that would definitely be my favorite skincare. And then other things that I have in my cabinet, as I look over there right now, after the accident, I found that my hair was really not, I don't know. I think that probably just having an accident that was that severe, I felt like my hair was not in great shape, and my hairstylist agreed with me on that one. So I take these hair gummy vitamins called Hello Lovely, which, according to the internet, probably will not help me at all, but makes me feel better. And then I have all sorts of dinosaur band-aids for my son and Doc McStuffin band-aids for my daughter.
Oh yes, we're right there with you with the dinosaurs. They are everywhere in this house. Yeah. Oh, well, thank you so much, Lydia. Like, to me, you are such an endearing, inspiring person. And I really hope that everyone goes out and, you know, read your first book. And also, I'm very excited to pre-order your second book.
Please do.
And then when is that coming out?
March 21st of 2023. It's called Claim Your Confidence, Unlock Your Superpower, and Live the Life You Want. And it's basically picks up where the last book left off. It starts with my book tour from the first one and all of the things that happen along the way. So I hope you guys will pick it up and I hope you will enjoy reading it as much as I enjoyed writing it.
Oh my goodness, I'm so excited. That title resonates with me so much. And then where can we find you?
Well, Instagram is always the easiest place to find me. I post all the time just because I think it's such a fun way to keep my parents updated on where I am in the world. and so just Lydia Finette, or you can find me on LinkedIn, you know, or I have a website, lydiafinette.com.
Thank you for listening to On the Shelf. Join us next month as we continue to talk to thought leaders and change makers in the world of wellness.